Everyone, John Worth, I'm here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week, the great Mats Wilander, 7-time Grand Slam champion, current Eurosport commentator, the eponym of Wilander on Wheels that we'll talk about, a road show that he's been doing for a number of years, and overall just one of the great overarching presence in this sport. This is a fun conversation. I think you'll see why Mats is so popular, why he's such an important member of the tennis community, always a good conversationalist, and this time was no exception. He's not in his home of Idaho, but he's on the other side of the ocean, but we'll talk to him now. Here's Mats Wilander. Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure speaking.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you.
Where are you? Where are we getting you?
I am in Palma de Mallorca.
Really?
Spain. Yes.
It ain't Idaho. What brings you there?
No, it's there was an ATP Champions Tournament last weekend where I played a couple of doubles. I did not play singles, but I played a few doubles with Mansoor Bahrami and Michael Pernforce, and Tim Henman jumped in, and so it was very nice. And I'm here for another 3 days doing tennis clinics, so tennis camps with Michael Pernforce and 12 Scandinavians.
12 Scandinavians in Mallorca sounds like the setup to a joke.
It's very Swedish, actually. Palma, Mallorca is quite Swedish. A lot of Swedes here, and it's a Swedish hotel and a Swedish-owned tennis club where they play the tournament. And really, really good spot.
Did you have anything to do with the Nadal Academy, or is this totally separate?
No, totally separate. Yeah, he's in over in Manacor, which is about 45-minute drive from Palma, but... So it's totally separate. We're just here for Moya, Tommy Haas, Ferrero, Henman, Malice, and Correa played the singles, and then they put a few doubles in between. So
let's talk tennis. What? It's mid-October. When you look out at the sport right now at this period of time, what are you seeing? Sort of big picture, where is professional tennis right now?
Wide open question. I think that both men's and on the women's side, there is a little bit of a change going on. At the top, obviously Novak Djokovic has stopped that debate, I suppose, winning the last two. But I still feel like there's, I mean, it's obvious that Rafa is getting older for obvious reasons, but you could just tell that he's not necessarily slowing down, but we might not see him at his best all the time for physical reasons. And I think that opens up a little bit of a void and the chance for the younger guys to come in. Obviously, Federer, the U.S. Open, I will discount that. But the last 3 or 4 months, he's lost close matches. So, they're not on their way out. But I think that there's a professional tennis right now. There's a good chance for young guys to come through. Unfortunately, we haven't seen it in the last 10, 15 years, but I think that it's inevitable that they're coming, and I think that the younger generation is coming. Obviously, on the women's side, it's already happened. And on the women's side, I'm not sure which of the older players are going to stop the young invasion. Serena is maybe able to, but so I think that's what I see. And obviously, when that happens, you start thinking about what's going to happen the day that Federer and Nadal and possibly Djokovic are not in the game anymore, or Serena, or Maria Sharapova. But I think that it's a good thing. It's going to happen. And we have, I guess you could say, survived changes like that before, with Björn Borg quitting and McEnroe not winning much after that. So I'm not worried. I'm excited. And I'm looking for new rivalries, really.
If you're going to back one or two horses on the men's side, we've been you said it, and it's we say it, and we don't even think about it when we say it's been 10 or 15 years since we've had a breakthrough, which is just remarkable. But if you were going to pick one or two horses to be the next player to win a major, not named Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray, Wawrinka, who do you like?
It's so hard to know what's going to happen to the likes of Kei Nishikori and Milos Raonic. And you're going to have to throw Grigor Dimitrov in there when these guys, the great four, big four are done. Are they going to be able to step up and suddenly gain that confidence to win majors? Or are the young guys going to push them out of the way? There's a lot of young guys. So for me, I think maybe at the moment, I think I'm looking at Stefanos Tsitsipas. I don't know if he's going to win a major in the next 3-4 years, but I think he's a pretty safe bet on heading to the top of the game. I think he's got a pretty big game. He's got a good head on his shoulders. He moves well for a big guy. Great attitude. Seems to enjoy the fight. Enjoys a bit of variation in his game. Obviously, Denis Shapovalov, but I think Tsitsipas for me is a safer bet than most others, apart from maybe Karen Khachanov. I think he's a full-on workhorse, huge game, great attitude, moves unbelievably well, and he's got good technique in most shots, and I think he's learned to manage the forehand side. So I think that's where I'm looking. I think what we found out, and again, we find out all the time, that if you have a couple of great players winning a lot of majors in one generation, the generation that comes behind usually suffers when Sampras Agassi wins most of it. Borg McEnroe wins and now. So, I mean, it's good to have stars in the game, but they do sort of delete a lot of potential Grand Slam winners by being just a little bit better and breaking their confidence down to basically nothing against them.
But when you say, I mean, people have always said to me the same thing. Boy, tennis is really going to be in trouble when Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Serena are gone. But wouldn't you take that bet? I mean, isn't that preferable to have these four reliable, unbelievable generational champions? Isn't that preferable to the alternative of every tournament's up for grabs and we don't have these solid stars?
I mean, I guess it is in a way, yes, because it brings tennis to the masses. And I think people tune in to Roger Federer. And obviously, by now, everyone knows he plays tennis. But I think people tune in that are not necessarily tennis fans because he's obviously transcended the sport. But I don't know. I look at the next generation as I do the generation that came after Sampras. And then, of course, Agassi hung in there a little bit longer than we thought. But, you know, that was Leighton Hewitt, Andy Roddick, Juan Carlos Ferrero, Marat Safin. And, I mean, they all won slams before Roger Federer won slams. And it seemed to me that maybe Sampras and Agassi kind of had to be out of there before Federer gained the confidence to believe he can win slams. I know he beat Pete Sampras in Wimbledon early on in his career, but he really didn't win as early as a lot of great champions did. But so I think that's what we're going to see. And I think a great star will come through. And a guy that refuses to lose of those younger guys, I think, and like on the women's side, I think they will come through. So, yeah, there might be a year or two or three when we're sort of who's going to be the rival, who's going to be the next guy, and we don't know. And then suddenly somebody comes through. And do you have to win 15 majors in our sport these days to be called a great champion? I don't think so. Right. I think 60-plus comes through and wins 4 or 5 or Shapovalov. I think that, you know, the era we've had now is so...
it's distorting, isn't it?
I don't know. It's unbelievable. But, I mean, you have to also look at what's happened, I believe, with slower courts, slower balls. The guys can play the same game on all the different surfaces and just look at Novak because that's basically what he does, and he's unbelievable at it. I think we're seeing tournaments change a little bit. Australian Open is much faster. We have more one-handed backhands coming up. We thought that was over. That's not over. They don't have to come from the bigger countries. I mean, suddenly we have a Greek player. We have somebody from Canada. I mean, it's so I don't think so. I think that tennis is in a very healthy place because of what Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic are doing and have done. And I think they've just raised the bar. I look at it as Tiger Woods in golf, where okay, we need that star, but the game is so good in golf right now, and I think that tennis will be. I mean, when you're crawling around the floor at home and you start hitting balls against the wall and you're looking at Roger Federer's one-handed backhand, you're going to go, well, hold on a second. I'm going to do that, but better. Right. And they're going to get better and stronger. And mentally, are they ever going to be at the same level as those three? I'm not 100% sure, but certainly physically, they're going to exceed those guys somehow.
Evolution's a beautiful thing. I was just telling a friend this. One of the great treats of covering the sport is when we travel, we get to hear you and we get to hear Barbara Shedd and we get to hear Eurosport, which is a completely different experience from American coverage and American TV. I'm wondering how you guys have covered Djokovic, which I think is sort of one of the great secrets in plain sight. It's sort of this great story that's hidden in front of us. What happened to the guy and then this remarkable comeback? And I think sometimes conflicts of interest get in the way. Sometimes relationships get in the way. I feel like this is a story that hasn't been properly told. And I'm curious, given the freedom you guys have on your broadcast, how you're handling the return of Novak Djokovic and the mysterious sabbatical he went on.
I think it's more mysterious that we're not talking about Roger Federer having a dry spell, not winning for 5 years. Nadal had a mysterious time in his career for a couple of years where he got injured, or did he, or did he not, or was he just not playing well, or wasn't able to practice? So I think Novak's road is more normal and natural than we have allowed ourselves to think that Federer and Nadal have been this superhuman. But I think in the end, you got to look at wins. Roger Federer covers it up in a completely different way. When he's not winning, he's still graceful. Rafa Nadal covers it up by not showing any negative emotion, but just going full on, and it doesn't matter how good he's playing. It's just me and him, or you and him, and he doesn't want to lose to you. With Novak, he's a little more, I think, more human in the way that he shows disappointment and satisfaction on a tennis court, and that's way more if you look back at what great champions have been like in the past, with maybe the exception of Jimmy Connors. But there have been ups and downs, and I think Federer and Nadal is just the way they have handled themselves through tough times. We don't really talk about them being in a slump. So Djokovic's slump was very short. Obviously, the elbow surgery was a big reason for it. I think conflict of interest off the court when you have two kids and a wife, you got to have new values. And I think that, you know, I think the way we've covered him is he's come so far to us in Europe, where he came out and obviously won the Australian Open. She's 10 years ago, I guess it is. And he was fragile. Emotionally, he was very fragile. And I covered that, and I was not impressed with the way he behaved on the court. But the way he has changed that and become a complete warrior, I think that to me is a bigger change than Roger Federer's backhand. I really do. I think Novak's mentality has just gone from not being very good to being unbelievably good, especially in big matches.
It's really interesting. I mean, the knock on Djokovic used to be just push him around a little, get him into the latter rounds like a boxer. Just hang in there for 7 or 8 rounds, and eventually he's going to tap out. And it's been a total transformation, hasn't it?
It has been a total transformation. I really think, though, also that famous match at the semis of the U.S. Open, or a couple of semis in a row, actually, against Roger Federer, obviously the one where he sort of went, okay, you know what? You served my forehand. I'm not letting you hit another winner. Right. I'm going for it. I'm right. Taking my chance. And he was completely committed to that shot. And he's won so many matches by committing to just saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to be full-on aggressive, and I'm going to beat myself. If I lose, I'm going to beat myself. Which hasn't happened very often, but then he's also showed the other side where, you know, he's fighting through a little bit of Wimbledon against Nadal. I would think the crowd was slightly on Nadal's side. Every time he's played Federer, the crowd is on Federer's side. That happens all the time, of course. And then U.S. Open, we're so dying to have Del Potro come back and win. And he's just figured out that, well, in this match against Del Potro, I am not going to try and out-hit the guy. I'm just going to be a human wall and not miss. So I think he's figured out so many different ways to win matches these days that in a big match, I say that there's players that have played big matches and there's big match players. And I would have to say that Novak Djokovic is as big a match player as anyone has ever seen.
You know what? One of the great pities of the U.S. Open for me was I heard the news that the Volander on Wheels van is in the shop. What's the status of what's the status of the van?
No, so what's happened this year is that I have I'm involved in starting to run a tennis club in Haley, Idaho, and it's taken a lot of my time to figure out how I'm going to be able to handle 3 indoor tennis courts and a big gym attached to it. So that has taken up a lot of time. Enough time where we haven't gotten on the road. We're going on the road here in November, going down to New Orleans. Man. We've done it for 9 years, 3 months a year. That's more than the 7-year itch, if you know what I mean. So I don't exactly know where we are. I can't imagine that we're not going to keep going because it's been one of the most fun things I've ever done in my life. Are we going to keep going 3 months a year in a motorhome or alter it a little bit? I mean, I started slicing backhands after a while instead of hitting topspin. So I think you evolve. You know, business has evolved. I evolved. Cameron Lickle has evolved. And we're getting older. And we'll figure out a way to keep Vlander on Wheels going the way we think it should be going. So the future, I think, is that we both love to teach tennis. And we'll get out there. We'll get out there for sure. It's just a matter of how we do it. Is it Vlander on Wheels or Vlander on water? Or we're not really sure. But my time has been taken up by starting to run this Gravity Fitness and Tennis in Haley, Idaho. You should come out and check it out.
It's Haley, Idaho.
High altitude training camp.
Excellent. My producer, Jamie's offered to be your designated driver for Vlander on Wheels when you go to New Orleans.
You know, that's a hard spot. I mean, I'd rather give up my teaching role in Vlander on Wheels. But the driver part, that's me. That's me because the driver picks the music. And I'm hanging out with Cameron Lickle, who's in his 30s. And we don't have the same music style. So the driver picks the music. So we don't need a driver, but we might need a trainer at some point.
She could do that, too. What's the club? Yeah. How close are you to the club in Idaho? You don't live
I'm
in Haley.
25.
Yeah, you don't live in Haley, right?
Yeah, I do live in. Yeah, I live in. No, Sun Valley is just sort of the stage name. I live in Haley.
Okay.
We're about 20-25 minutes from civilization in general, and the tennis club is obviously in civilization, so it's close enough. I've never been involved in a tennis club. I'm still going to travel sort of 4, 5, 6 months a year, depending on the year. But I now feel I would love to have, and I now do have a place to go when I get home, play tennis, teach tennis, spend 3-4 hours on a court. I love hitting balls. I love teaching tennis with anyone. So this is a new chapter in my life, and hopefully we can get some of our sort of deadhead fans that we've gathered for the last 9 years to come to Idaho and ski in the winter, play tennis in the afternoon, or come and fly fish. We call it the Augusta of fly fishing. That's where we are in Blaine County, and then play some tennis as well. So we're not really sure where we're going with it, but I'm really excited. But we do have some very interesting projects still for Vlander on Wheels.
That's good living. I used to see the van even at the U.S. Open when they would they would park it on the other side of the bridge there by the Eunice van. I always thought, what a great message that sent, that spoke as well as anything to the universal appeal of tennis. You could take that anywhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Please don't tell anyone that we also spent nights in it and slept in it, because some nights we finish late at the U.S. Open. I got to get up early and do Vlander on Wheels clinics over at Forest Hills, so... Where do we sleep? We sleep in the van in the parking lot H, but don't tell the U.S. Open because I don't think they allow us anymore. But we get woken up by people kicking soccer balls into the wall, into the side of
the
bus.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, right.
Yeah.
I posted a photo once in the parking lot. Your van was actually one of the goals for, it looked like everyone was wearing, I think it was El Salvadorian soccer league, and your van was one of the goals. I love that story. You know, that reminds me of one of my favorite stories about you, that a friend saw you in Melbourne Airport, and everyone is flying home from the Australian Open, and you're sitting there on a chair, and he goes up to you and he says, how come you're not down in the lounge? How come you're not in the Qantas lounge with the rest of the beautiful people? And you say, I don't want to be with the beautiful people. That story always stuck with me, and I'm curious. As I think about that, and as you tell me about sleeping in a motorhome during the U.S. Open, where do you think you got that sensibility? I mean, where'd your values come from?
I think the values come from obviously how you're raised with your parents, and having two older brothers. And I grew up in a tiny, tiny town in Sweden with not much to do except sports. I grew up playing tennis with mostly people that were older than me, so. You always got sort of coached or talked to by them and how to behave, and still didn't want to lose to them. But so I think that I was, I don't know, I'm lucky in that way. But it's also, you know, I guess when you've been traveling as much as we all have, I think that there's a little bit of a wild person in there, and I'm looking for adventure at all times. Obviously, being on tennis court in the semis or finals of Grand Slams, that's a great adventure, but that ended. And so, yeah, I'm... Tennis is, you know, it's my passion. It doesn't turn me into a beautiful person at all. I love the sport, and I'm always trying to give back to it as much as I possibly can. I think there has never, ever been a tennis player that's even close to being as important as the game itself. I'm hoping Roger Federer comes along and plays the French Open next year, because I think it's a shame that he doesn't play there. I understand the reasons for it. But again, no one's bigger than the game. And we all owe the game for the rest of our lives. So that's what I'm interested in. And hey, the lounges, I'm not sure. They're crowded too. So
it's only an extra squirt of Pepsi. Fine.
Yeah. What, so I don't know. I'm not sure, John. I think you find that with a lot of tennis players. I think you see us in the middle of the heat of the battle, and you know, you hang around, and it's it's a sort of an upper class sport, or it's expensive, or whatever it is. We make a lot of money, and we travel, and it's glamorous, or whatever. But that's not what's interesting to me. Interesting is to try and come down and be as normal as I was before I turned pro, and that's me. So, and I think a lot of pros are. And not comfortable necessarily with what you call the beautiful people.
You mentioned Federer, and we were talking about this a few weeks ago. I don't know if you were you at Laver Cup? Did you make it there at all?
I didn't make it there. No, I watched it religiously on TV. I did last year as well, so I did not see it live.
I mean, it was remarkable on a number of levels. One of them was, I think, first and foremost, just the level of emotional buy-in from the players. You kept hearing this isn't an exhibition, don't call it an exhibition, but it really didn't feel like one. But one thing that really struck me was it got me thinking where Roger Federer fits into tennis post-career. And in a lot of ways, it's in keeping what you're saying of the sport trumps everything. But here's someone who brings capital, he brings sponsors, he has a terrific gift for working a room, for dealing with people, there's authenticity. Where do you see... You have any sense of where Roger fits into this whole matrix when he's done playing?
I think he fits in together with, let's just call Roger Federer, with great humans of our time. And great humans that will go down in history as somebody who's done a lot of things that have changed people's inspiration and changed the world. And I think that he's so... And what's so cool is that he is just that normal guy. And then he steps on the court and he's this genius. But when he's in a room he's just a normal person, the way he was when he grew up. And you see his parents in the player box and they're applauding for both players and they're showing nerves. And Robert is obviously nervous, and you can see it. But, I mean, at some point you think he would stop being nervous because Roger's won so much. But no, not at all, because he's – and I think that's – it's just And the most important part about Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal and a lot of others being that normal is that that's why they're the best players of all time to me, because they have that respect as they have when they walk into a room. For every person in there, they have respect. That goes on to the court, and they respect the guy across the net so much that they lose sight of everything else except the guy across the net. And because of that respect and humility, they are able to pretty much never ever lose to a guy they shouldn't lose to. And that it starts with a yes, I don't want to lose, that's for sure. But it also starts with checking out your opponent, checking out his strengths, checking out his weaknesses, being prepared, knowing what he does good, what he's not good at, when he chokes, when he wins, blah blah blah. That's why they're the best players in the world. You cannot just overlook your opponent and think you will have consistent success. And I think the young players today need to really, really look at that, because they show up every single day and they don't play their best, but you could never ever tell that they don't. And they figure out weaknesses of their opponent and they try to make their opponent worse rather than relying on their own strength. They rather exploit their other guy's weaknesses. That's respect to me.
That's really interesting. And I also I wonder too, as I hear you say that, what is the impact on the other side of the net? when you're the opponent and Federer and Nadal are project this humility and they're not unapproachable and you see them in the locker room and they acknowledge you, I wonder what impact that has on the opponent. How do you really psych yourself up to beat Roger Federer when he's such a normal guy who is acknowledging you as you walk out there onto the court?
I think a lot of players are not able to do that. They're not able to see. I mean, obviously, we look at Jimmy Connors as maybe the greatest competitor and fighter of all time in many ways, together with Rafael Nadal. And Jimmy had some tricks, you know, up his sleeve. And you could sometimes find a little nerve in yourself that says, listen, I don't like what he's doing right now. Is that aimed at me or is it not? Or so, you know what, I don't like that. And I don't want to lose to a guy who does that. So you could find another reason to not want to lose. Whereas with Federer and Nadal, I'm with you. I don't know how guys get up for it. I think a lot of guys don't. And I think a lot of guys dread playing them. I think they have a good time playing them, but they're not necessarily really upset if they don't win. And I think, yes, they get a lot of matches for free that are won in the locker room. And I think most probably more so for Nadal than Federer. But, yeah, I think that's a problem. But that's a brilliant move by them, you know. That's right. With John McEnroe, yeah, sometimes you're like, I don't want to lose to this. What is he doing? Blah, blah, blah. That doesn't happen with Federer and Nadal. So I take my hat off to guys like Novak Djokovic who can actually look past that and just take them for tennis players. And I'm not losing to a guy who hits one-handed backhands, basically.
That's I've always remind what Charles Barkley used to say about Michael Jordan, which is, you know, you want to be his friend while he kills you. You're in the wearables game, I hear.
Yes.
I was looking up something about your career, and I came across NeuroTennis, a wearable that provides the wrist with instantaneous auditory feedback. What does that mean?
That means that it's a wearable that you wear on the impact hand. So a right-hander wears it on his right wrist, and it's a wearable that detects the impact of the ball on your racket. And really, when you play tennis, there are two triggers. There's only two triggers, and it's when I hit, and it's when my opponent hits. And certain things need to happen before I hit, after I hit. During the hit, you do your best to get the ball somewhere close to the lines. But before you hit, you got to prepare. After you hit, you got to recover. Before your opponent hit, you got to prepare. And after he hits, you got to recover or prepare. We've come up with this because we have, with Cameron Lickle, VLander on Wheels, we're out playing with two brothers from Washington, D.C., who are geniuses in our world, and they're software engineers. And one of them said one time, I was playing with him, and he said, I need VLand ear. And I said, what on earth is VLand ear? Is it a bad pronunciation of my name? I said, no, I need you in my head. I need you in my ear. Like, I need you to tell me, because I keep telling him, split step, go to the middle, keep moving. He said, I need you all the time. And they came up with this wearable, and it tells you what you need to be doing, how you need to set yourself up to have the possible best result. I think if you go and listen to a good coach teaching tennis, they're not telling you necessarily what you did wrong. It's more positive to try and tell them what they need to do right and try your best to do that. And then the result of your shot is really the feedback. But we forget. I put it on and I'm like, oh my God, it's telling me to move my feet. It's telling me to turn my shoulders. It's telling me to watch the ball. And I realize I'm actually not watching the ball. And if I forget, then amateurs are going to be helped so much by these commands that repeat. And the beauty of the product is if you're working on your forehand, it has 5, 6, 7 commands that come on every time you hit or your opponent's hit, or you can change it and have every third time you hit. You don't have it on when your opponent, but you can also program your own command. So for you, John, it might be, hey, John, move your feet after you hit the ball, or John, get back to the middle, or watch the ball.
You know me well.
It's not like you, yes, I guess, but you don't necessarily, and you want to try and think of 5 or 6 things at the same time without thinking about them. We have it, who started playing tennis at 4 or 5 years old, but somebody who's an amateur and has started late in life, moving your feet when the other guy is hitting, making a split step when the other person is hitting, watching the ball until it hits your strings like Roger Federer does, it's not that easy to remember. So you have this command and this little speaker on your wrist where you hear it. No one else hears it but you. It's an unbelievable workout because when it tells you to move your feet, you're thinking, does it? No, I'm not moving my feet properly. So we have these other apparatus where you can measure the spin of your ball. And I don't know, do I need to know if I hit it at 1,000 RPMs or 2 or 3 or 4,000 or how do I do that? I rather have a positive command of what I should try and do. And hopefully I do it, and then the result is that the ball goes in. So neurotennis, I think, yes, I love the idea, and I love the fact that a coach can go in and tell somebody who owns a neurotennis wearable that, listen, I'm going to put in a few commands for you because you're not moving your feet or you're not turning your shoulders, and you need to do that more than other people. So my voice will be on there. With that command, and that's what neurotennis is. Go on the website, please, neurotennis.com, neurotennis.com/shop, and you can sign up and be one of the first to have an ability or a chance to buy them when they start coming out here in a couple of months.
That's very cool. That makes 10,000 steps seem very obsolete, I have to tell you. This seems next level.
There you go. I mean, exactly.
All right, this was great. Well, maybe we'll do this again in Australia, if that's cool. But this is terrific.
Anytime, John.
Always
anytime.
A pleasure. It's 6 p.m. in Mallorca, so go eat lunch. And this was great. Let's always a pleasure, seriously. And we will link that's actually really we're going to link to the product, but always a pleasure. We want to see Velodra on wheels back on the road.
All right. Thank you very much, John. Have a great day back in the States. And yes, I'll go and have lunch here in Spain.
You as well. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Mats. All right. Thanks to Mats for joining us. Thanks, as always, to Jamie Lasanti. Jamie Lasanti, as I bring you in, I will just say that is my kind of guy. Love that guy. And I think you got a sense of this is a 7-time Grand Slam champion. This is a Hall of Famer. This is a truly elite tennis player. You would never know it talking to him. There's a real modesty, but there's also a real sense of engagement. I enjoyed that. And I don't know what struck you. I don't know if you've ever met Mats or spoken to him, but again, you will not find a more modest and humble figure in the tennis community. This is a guy who he comes in and he's wearing a backpack, and we were talking about the lounge, but there is no special access for him, and he does not care. He cares about the sport, though. So, I enjoyed that conversation. I don't know if anything struck you, but jump in. How'd you like that?
It's great. He's really interesting, and I appreciate his opinions, especially on Djokovic. I think he makes a good point there about how, you know, everyone was talking about Djokovic and his downfall and how he was going through this time and will he ever be back? And now, of course, he has proven us all wrong, but he made the point that Federer and Nadal and others have also gone through periods of this in their careers, and people made too much of a deal of it, or, you know, kind of everyone goes through that.
That is not what I expected him to say. I think we could push back a little and say, yes, Federer had a 5-year drought when he wasn't winning majors, but he was still getting to finals. The Djokovic swoon for a guy who reliably was getting to Grand Slam semis. I mean, it was something like 23 out of 25 Grand Slam semis, and then suddenly for about 18 months was struggling to get to the second week of majors. I could push back a little there, but no, I thought that was really an interesting. I thought that was an interesting point. And again, Mats is a straight shooter, and he's also. I mean, we don't watch Eurosport in the United States, but he's also really a prominent A-list tennis commentator and an analyst. He's on the road. He does a game set Mats segment on Eurosport. He's at all the majors, so he's on the road a fair amount too. But I also thought it was interesting what he said about how the humility of Federer Nadal actually has a competitive advantage. And sometimes with stars, and this is hardly just an issue to tennis. I mean, it's hardly unique to tennis, but sometimes stars get to a certain level and people say, who was that guy? I was just heard a great story about how Michael Jordan was behaving the summer when he was drafted in the summer of 1984. And that person is unrecognizable from the Michael Jordan who became the great NBA player. But I think it's interesting that he saw it as a competitive advantage, that it actually is conducive to their winning, that Federer and Nadal have kept this level of humility. You're kind of shaking your head?
Yeah.
You're a little skeptical?
A little bit, yeah. I get it. But I think any player that's at the professional level would kind of laugh at that and be like, yeah, at the surface, you know, maybe I think about that when I wake up in the morning, but by the time I brush my teeth, it's pretty much like, this is what I do for a living. I'm a competitor. You know, I'm going to play my hardest against this person. I think us mortals probably have that in the back of our minds when we think, what would I do if I stood across the net and, you know, Federer is standing there. But when you're, you know, we've seen them fall many times in early rounds
like
to
need...
people who...
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think, you know, look at John Millman just got done beating Roger Federer. So it's not as, but I think his point is well taken, that an individual sport, it helps to have extra motivation or some sort of personal animus to help you beat the other guy. And I remember early in Federer's career when you just sensed that the opponent was almost satisfied losing to Federer. I mean, it almost didn't have suspense in the outcome because the opponent was resigned to losing to this nice guy who played beautiful tennis, who I can't really get mad at because he's such a cool guy.
I think after the fact, though, that's when that comes into play. I don't think you, like I said, wake up in the morning, go out there, and that's what you're thinking. Like, you know, if
that's
I lose,
fair point.
I
fair
think
point.
After the fact, when you look at the scoreboard and you take a deep breath, you're not going to go and, you know, be a sore loser. You're going to sort of calm down and go ahead and shake his hand and kind of say, all right, well, I lost to Roger Federer, you know. Tomorrow's another day, you know, and you kind of move on. But I don't think it's not a mentality thing throughout the entire match. At least I hope not.
I think one thing that's interesting about Wilander especially, he won one fewer major than Andre Agassi. He won the same number as McEnroe, one fewer than Jimmy Connors, only four fewer than Bjorn Borg. I'm not sure that people see him necessarily as one of the great titans of tennis, which he is. I mean, he had one of the great all-time great seasons. He probably cut his career a bit short. He's, again, one of these 30 is a new 20. This is a guy who was by the time he hit 30 years old, he was done winning. But he's had a really, really, I mean, this is an absolute Hall of Fame, Mount Rushmore type of career. Seven majors on a variety of surfaces. You know, won all three majors, did not win Wimbledon, but otherwise won three of the four majors. This is a formidable tennis career. And for whatever reason, whether it's his own humility, whether it's the fact that he didn't draw attention to himself, he's probably my size. I mean, he's not a towering physical presence. Played at the same time as McEnroe, who took a lot of the oxygen out of the room. I'm not sure history has quite given him his due as a player. If I told you a year ago, John McEnroe and Mats Wilander each won seven majors.
I think that's fair. Do you think that... We talk about Federer, Nadal, Djokovic. Do you think I have one player in mind, but do you think there's a player that is suffering from the same sort of effect maybe as he is?
I'm curious who. I mean, I always had a theory that players marketed themselves in tennis after their retirement. So Ivan Lendl goes away for years and years. We later learned that may have been tied to a lawsuit. But, you know, Pete Sampras is not interested in coaching, being a commentator, being much of a presence, and I wonder if that doesn't undercut his achievements. Conversely, John McEnroe is absolutely everywhere.
Right.
And maybe the same way Charles Barkley in the NBA. I mean, I think players define their careers some ways after they retire. And John McEnroe's absolute ubiquitous presence probably gives him more stature than his
recency effect, basically.
Yeah, there's a recency effect. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Steffi Graf, same way.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say.
Was that yours?
No.
Who was yours? I'm curious.
No. That's what I was going to say in that example. But I'm thinking with Mats, you mentioned Borg. Is there something that happens like down the road if Wawrinka wins more majors and suddenly he's close to double digits? Does he have a similar
effect?
The
countryman, okay.
Yeah, something like that where he disappears after he retires and doesn't, maybe not, he's not as high profile as someone like Federer.
That's really interesting. I mean, it's Borg, and also I would add Edberg, who played probably a more aesthetically pleasing game and won at Wimbledon when Wimbledon was far and away the most prestigious of the four majors. I think that probably goes into it. That's an interesting point. Yeah, Stan Wawrinka
basically,
in
is
some
there
way
anyone,
obscured. Yeah, that's
is there any players that will end up being obscured because of Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, countrymen or not, but people who, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of their careers, you look back, as you said, at major totals and how many majors they've won across all of them, and you say, wow, well, they've won the same, but they don't seem like the same caliber of player looking back. Is that, you know, are we going to get to that point? It's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that happens a lot. I mean, I think you just sort of look at the math going forward, and Matt's talked about this a little bit, that we're so spoiled, it's a joke. I mean, if a player today wins, you know, if you said to Zverev, you're going to win 3-4 majors for your career, it's sign me up. Mm-hmm. I mean, the notion we're going to have this double-digit major winners.
Sure.
Right now, we have three of them and four if you count Serena, and Venus has seven. I mean, it's just comedy because back
that's
in
true.
The old days, you know, seven majors was made you John McEnroe. Now seven majors and you're...
It's not necessarily, you know, the standard.
Exactly.
It's
going to be an interesting correction period for tennis. But anyway, good conversation with Matt. Always a favorite. Man of the people. Love that guy.
Yeah.
All right. We will have another podcast next week. Thanks to Matt. Thanks, as always, to Jamie. Pleasure.
Thank you, John.
Remind us, as you do each week, if people were so interested in subscribing or leaving reviews, where might they go about doing that?
They go on Apple Podcasts and they can click subscribe so that they get their podcast delivered to their phone so they can download and listen right away. And they should leave a review.
There you go. You heard it from Jamie. All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening. Keep the suggestions coming. We'll do it again in 4 weeks. We'll be right back.